Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall.
And I'm Joe Keating.
Hey Joe, how's it going? How's your PhD?
Yeah, it's good. I've started looking into the diversity of vertebrate bone and all sorts of interesting things, doing some histology, soaring through some heterostracan bone, which are these a group of jawless fish, and it takes forever to saw through their bone. I sat in the department today for about, must have been 6 hours, sawing, and it sawed about, I think, 5 millimetres.
Don't you have any lab hands to do that for you?
All you need to do is just for someone to watch the saw so it doesn't, like, break itself. So I just sat in and read some, what was I reading? About molecular evolution today, because I know nothing about that and I'm brushing up.
So, how far into your PhD are you? You're only a couple of weeks still, aren't
Yeah,
you?
yeah. I'm freshly started. I think I'm in my fourth week or fifth week.
Cool. And
Yeah, it's going
you're
well.
already into doing the practical side of it. You're already doing the research.
Well, this is just a sort of training exercise, really, to get me to look at some fish histology, some bone histology. It's training because I'm off to Switzerland this Christmas to use the synchrotron to delve
Nice.
into the depths of some bone tissue. So this will help me know what to look for.
And so it's pretty useful today that we're talking about the evolution of early vertebrates.
Yes, well, this is my topic. So I was dead excited to set this interview up. So Lauren's going to be talking about the Devonian, which is probably my favourite period because it's the most exciting in terms of vertebrate evolution. It's when vertebrate faunas changed radically beyond belief. And, well, I'll let her do the talking.
So thanks very much for joining us today, Lauren.
Thank you very much for setting it up.
One thing I want to know before we start is, what is actually a vertebrate and what's a chordate? What's the line between the two? What defines them?
Okay. So an early vertebrate is any animal with a backbone, as it's known popularly, that exists in the Paleozoic, which is between 520 and 250 million years ago, roughly. However, most of the vertebrates alive back then don't have what we would consider a backbone. They don't actually have vertebrae, which is supposed to define the group. Instead, they have things like a notochord, which is a stabilizing rod that goes all the way along the back of the animal. They have other characteristics, such as a postanal tail. They have eyes in general. They have gill arches for breathing and supporting the actual gills. They also have muscle blocks running across the along the entire body. However, the difficulty with this is that there are other things that have these characteristics as well, especially early on. There are other members of a larger group known as chordates, which include things like tunicates, which as adults are sacs sitting on the bottom filter feeding food through what is actually their gill bars, but as juveniles look somewhat like tadpoles. Another member of this group are the famous amphioxus or the lancelets, which also have muscle blocks and may have a postanal tail. And going further out to the deuterostomes, that is things where the anus forms first rather than the mouth, as opposed to, say, protostomes, which are most insects, other invertebrates, this group has some of the same characteristics. So early members of, say, the echinoderms, which are things like starfishes and sea urchins, actually also have gill slits, and they may also have a postanal tail. And then the same thing with the acorn worms that are the other group of deuterostomes that are not either chordates or vertebrates. So it gets kind of difficult to define what a vertebrate is the further back you go. So the field of early vertebrates deals with sort of the origins of vertebrate groups, working out their interrelationships, and finding out exactly when they show up.
So when did they first evolve?
So vertebrates actually date back to the Cambrian, just like most other large groups. So at the Burgess Shale, which is famous for having all sorts of arthropods and all sorts of other invertebrates, you actually find Picea there, which might be a vertebrate and which might not. It's supposed to have muscle blocks, which are another vertebrate characteristic, but it has some really weird tentacles coming off the front of the head. Other caddates are found in China that are about the same age, 500 million years ago or so, that have more distinct muscle blocks, which might have a notochord, which is sort of a gelatinous mass that goes all the way down the spine before there are actual vertebra. But those are under some debate as well. So the first definite vertebrates are more found in the Ordovician, which is the next stage, somewhere around 470 million years ago. And those are actually jawless vertebrates. So jawed vertebrates don't show up until the Silurian, which is about 420 million years ago.
Okay, so they had this kind of. It was before they had bones, so they had just a little. I don't know what you'd call it, just an unmineralized, fleshy backbone, sort of. Would that have had the same function? Was it all sensory, nervous system?
It's not really a nervous system, it's more for support. So it's a gelatinous mass that really just holds the body stable. And so the notochord is actually still found in human embryos, for example. It's there before the spinal cord shows up. And the nerve cord is something distinct from that. The notochord is also persistent in some of the fishes that are alive today, things like the chondrosteans, that's paddlefish and sturgeon. Things like shark, the vertebrae actually grow around the notochord. And that's how vertebrae formed in the first place.
All right, okay. So what did these, you said that one of the first ones we see actually has tentacles on its face, and you're saying that some of them don't have jaws. So what did they generally look like? Is it completely not what we're used to seeing today in terms of fish? Are they completely off there in terms of morphology?
Well, they're pretty recognizable. So in water, there's really limits if you're a vertebrate to what you can look like. So most things tend to be fish-shaped, which is fusiform, kind of like a torpedo. These early ones, some of them are shaped like that. Some of them are more eely. So Picea, the one with tentacles off the front of its head, which may or may not be a vertebrate, tends to look more like a leaf, an elongated leaf. Some of the other early ones, like the conodonts, which their teeth are found all over the place in the Paleozoic, actually do just look like eels, and they have giant eyes at the front end. So they'd be pretty recognizable as fish after a certain point. It's just not clear whether they're vertebrates or chordates.
And so when they finally did develop bone, what was the reasoning for that? If they could survive with just the gelatinous notochord, why is it that they eventually ended up developing skeletons?
It seems to be for defense. So the first bony tissue that we see actually occurs on the outside of the body as small scales early in the Ordovician. And we find these isolated. And also, these develop into giant plates around the head. So some of the earliest jawless fishes that you see look like a clamshell with this tail sticking out the back end and two eyes at the front
Oh,
and
wow.
tiny between. So those contain all the classic tissues of bone, like the dentin and the enamel and the pulp cavity. And these dermal bones kind of consolidate together to form what's the skull inside humans. So it's the same bones that used to be on the outside are now on the inside and covered with skin and consolidated. Whereas in the fishes, especially living fishes, the Raphen fishes, which are usually dismissed as having too many bones, it's the same ones, they just haven't sort of fused together. And then you have a second sort of bone just besides dermal bone, which forms internally as things like the neurocranium, which is the brain case, get ossified secondarily, but it's the same kind of tissue.
Okay, so how did the bones go from the outside onto the inside? Was it something that they just found useful, I guess, to have as a structure rather than just as a defense?
Well, even with the defense, there was probably always some skin over the scales, sort of like in modern sharks, you can't see all of their little tiny tooth-like scales sticking out. So going internally is probably just from fusion of the bone to the internal structures, which were already there in cartilage. So sort of like the notochord is the sac of that kind of tissue, you can have bone grow around it. It's the same kind of process. And then when the vertebra form, which seems to define vertebrates, they evolve independently in different lineages. So the kind of vertebra that sharks have arose independently of the kind of vertebra that humans and living bony fishes have. And that seems to be for stability. So there's actually been a series of experiments where John Long at Vassar College, who's not the same John Long as the paleontologist, actually built robots that had either a notochord tail or a vertebra tail to see how much in control they were and show that the vertebra actually helped with controlling where the robot is actually swimming.
So can you actually tell, can you actually trace the bones on the outside of these early fishes to the bones that we have inside us? Can you point to a fish and just the part of the bone on top of it say, that is now part of my arm or skull or?
It depends how far back you're willing to go. So it all should be related, but as you go further back, it becomes more difficult to say exactly what has been obtained. And so if you go to something like a lobe-finned fish, you can definitely say, okay, well, that is the humerus. That's probably the femur. Just looking inside these lobate fins, they're not functioning as limbs at all. And with the dermal bones, it's the same. You can say, okay, that's the frontal, and the frontal is also found in the human skull. When you go back further than that, the difficulty becomes that we don't really know how the early jawed fishes are related to each other and what their forebears look like. Also, in the fossil record, things like lobe-finned fish seem to come out of nowhere. And now we know that some things like, for example, the acanthodians, the spiny sharks are probably coming off of their stem, but they don't have the same kind of dermal bone on the outside. So the dermal bone is homologous. It's the same tissue produced in all of the vertebrates, but the exact nature of the bones is hard to track back past a certain point.
Okay, how far can we actually trace back our lineage?
So for the lobe-finned fishes, which includes the tetrapods, they go back to 420 million years ago when the first ones show up in China. So those are things like Sauropus and Guiyu that show up. They still have spines like these spiny sharks, the acanthodians, which is why they think there's a relationship. But tracking jawed vertebrates back before that is difficult because they don't really have a body fossil record until they suddenly appear out of nowhere in China at this certain point in time.
So, could you tell us a little bit about the Devonian? Why is this period of particular interest to paleontologists studying early vertebrates?
Because that's when the jawed fishes really get going. So we have jawless fishes in huge abundance in the period before that in the Silurian. In the early Devonian, they still dominate ecosystems. But in the Devonian is when you start getting things like coelacanths, like lungfishes, when you get the first early tetrapods showing up right at the end. So that's really when you can sort of trace back the origins of modern groups. And it's the same thing with sharks. It's the same thing with the ray-finned fishes. The first one shows up in the mid-Devonian. And you get all these other strange forms like the armored placoderms, which are jawed fishes that don't have any descendants left alive today. Well, except that they're paraphyletic. So technically, all jawed vertebrates alive are their descendants. However, there's nothing that's directly descended from the forms that were around at the end of the Devonian. So much attention is paid because that's when you get the fossils that hold the key to how these things are related to each other and where they might have originated.
So, how did the diversity change from the start of the Devonian to the end?
So there was a real turnover between sort of these jawless fish-dominated faunas. You have things with armor that are probably suction feeding and ram feeding and doing most of the jobs of fishes with jaws into sort of a more complex vertebrate ecosystem where you have these jawed fishes that include shell crushers, that include large predators, that include small predators, that include bottom feeders. And so at that point, you see the armored agnathans, which are called the ostracoderms, even though that's an incorrect statement because they're actually more closely, some of them are more closely related to jawed fishes than to each other. They start to peter out over the Devonian and they eventually die off towards the end. But it's not clear whether this is because of competition with the jawed fishes or caused by some outside pressure.
Was there anything big going on in the ecosystems at the time?
So there's a changeover from endemism, that is having species really based at certain areas in different parts of the globe. So you have a different set of species in China than you have in Australia than you have in the UK. to cosmopolitanism. At the time, what happened is that Pangaea was forming. So you have Gondwana, which is all the southern hemisphere continents, join up with North America and Europe, and to a lesser extent, China and Russia, and the closing of the seaway. And what happens then is that all of these fishes from the southern hemisphere come up into the northern hemisphere. And at that point, you have basically a very distinct late Devonian fauna of jawed vertebrates that's found basically all over the place.
So, how do you measure the biodiversity in the fossil record?
So you measure it by looking at a few different things. So first, you can look at taxonomic diversity, which is the amount of species there are in any particular stage all over the world. You can also look at regional diversity, close up on, say, just how many species are in North America versus somewhere else. You can also look at occurrences, how many times these species show up in the fossil record during a particular period, their abundances, how many individuals you find at a certain site. And you can also look at functional diversity, just how many different ecological jobs were they doing based on the morphology of their jaws, of their dentition, their body shapes. And that links into something known as disparity, which is morphological diversity in general, which is usually used to figure out the ecology of these early forms through comparison with the living.
So was there also a bit of a revolution in terms of the ecology then as well, and the disparity in forms at this time?
Yes, so that's actually been quantified a bit by Phil Anderson and his colleagues for the Devonian, where they found that there's sort of this huge increase in the diversity of jaw forms and dentition early on in the Devonian, but that hits stasis by the middle of the period. So basically, all of the jawed vertebrate functional forms are supposed to be around right at the moment the jawed vertebrates are really coming to the fore and the jawless vertebrates are going out. So you see a whole bunch of new traces of predation on the shelly invertebrate fauna. You find bite marks on crinoids. You find increase in armor on all of these invertebrates. That's just that the vertebrate ecosystem is becoming more complex. And so you have more predation, and then that drives further changes in the ecosystem. And so it becomes ever more complex going through to the end of the period. And then it's the same thing in the Carboniferous after the mass extinction event, where you actually have this situation where the predators of, say, crinoids are eliminated, but the crinoids come through unscathed. And so what happens is crinoids diversify like crazy. They form their own limestone. And then at the next step, you start to get these sharks, these whole cephalids that actually have crushing tooth plates. And so that leads to turnover in the crinoid fauna as well. So you have these after effects of the Devonian mass extinction in that you have changes in predation both before and after the mass extinction event.
Are you able to assign, well, are you able to link specific teeth to a specific role, ecological role?
Yes, so teeth are highly functional and they're also highly plastic. So most living fishes actually have different sets of teeth within their mouths that are used for different jobs. In these early lobe-finned fishes, you have things called coronoid fangs, for example, where you have these giant fangs within the mouth and then smaller teeth on the outside. And by looking at modern fishes that have the same kind of dentition, you can infer what the earlier fishes were doing, along with, say, the morphology of their lower jaws, which shorter lower jaws are better for producing powerful forces for, say, crushing, and longer lower jaws are better for closing fast for snapping at prey. So there is sort of a tight correlation between the morphology of teeth and the morphology of jaws and the jobs that the fishes were doing. And so that's how we can infer possibly what these early vertebrates were eating and what they were doing in the ecosystem. So jawless vertebrates have been sort of underrated functionally. They can actually do most of the jobs that jawed fishes do now, which are things like suction feeding, feeding off the bottom, ram feeding, which is swimming around with your mouth open, capturing prey without any kind of processing. So they were probably capable of forming something like a jawed vertebrate ecosystem, but it's those other jobs, the things like shell crushing or actually biting at prey or doing any kind of processing at all that jaws are required for. And so it may be that when you get those jobs, that's when you get this turnover between the agnathan and the jawed fish faunas in the Devonian.
Are any of these measures biased by the quality of the fossil record?
Well, everything's a little bit biased. Record is not nearly as bad as people have made out. So vertebrates unlike a lot of invertebrates, tend to preserve pretty well. They have bone, they have teeth. Teeth are made of enamel. They last basically forever. So even if you don't have body fossils, you can still get some sense of what's going on from what's called the ichthyolith record, which is microfossils of vertebrates, including teeth, scales, things like that. So vertebrates tend to be pretty well preserved. They tend to be pretty well preserved with each other, so you don't have any bias towards particular groups above other groups that have bones, at least for the jawed vertebrates. The jawless vertebrates are another story because sometimes they're just sacks of flesh and they don't get preserved at all except for their teeth. It's, of course, not as good as the invertebrate fossil record, but then invertebrates are, especially benthic shelly invertebrates, are always a lot more abundant than vertebrates are, so it might reflect some real signal. But if you have phylogenetic information, you can also reconstruct where you think the vertebrates should be, when you think they should have diverged based on whether or not their outgroups are around at that time. So there are ways to sort of get around the biases. You can look, for example, at faunal composition and just look at sites with vertebrates and see how many vertebrates are there, and then just compare site to site, even if you can't get an absolute number of vertebrates alive at any one time.
Okay. I just kind of like to explore a bit more about why this vertebrate diversity increased in the Devonian. What possible reasons could there have been?
Well, there are other things going on during the Devonian too. So it's not just the vertebrate diversity that increases. There's a phenomenon known as the Devonian nectonic revolution, where you have the rise of new Eurypterids, for example, new ammonites, new forms of trilobites. You also have a massive increase in the diversity of benthic invertebrates, in which you have the appearance of, say, new spines, new defense mechanisms. So it seems as though the whole ecosystem is being revolutionized, and it's actually been called the mid-Paleozoic Marine Revolution. It may be because you have the spread of taxa or species into new areas with the loss of endemism. It could also be because it's an unusually warm period in Earth history and you don't have polar ice caps or anything to that effect. There are few bioevents early on, but those tend to increase later, and perhaps that sets off repeated rounds of diversification. But it's not really clear why this period in particular is so productive for vertebrates when other periods are marked by stasis, for example, the later Permian or late Carboniferous.
Did any of the other groups continue with their increase in diversity through into the mid-Devonian? Or was it a kind of global thing with the jawed vertebrates that the increase happened in the early Devonian and then kind of went on a hiatus in the mid-Devonian?
So there hasn't actually been that much work on the other groups, but from my understanding, I think Eurypterids did sort of hit the same kind of stasis. So you have your major group set up and then going. It may be that just at that point, the ecosystem is saturated, and so that itself induces stasis, with these adaptive radiations early in the Devonian having been set off by some kind of opportunity available at that time. Now, if you think about it, for example, the Ordovician extinction happens only 20 million years before the start of the Devonian, because the Silurian is actually a really short period. So it may be some repercussions of that. It may be that jawed vertebrates evolving sets off some kind of trophic cascade or other effects through the ecosystem that results in everything else having to change to adapt, or there may be some third cause. It's not entirely clear. This is an area that needs a lot more research, especially on fishes. It really hasn't been that long that people have been focused on, say, biogeographic changes in early vertebrates or changes in diversification of early vertebrates, maybe the last couple decades or so. So it needs a lot more work.
Well, that's hopefully what Joe's going to be doing for us.
Yeah. So one hypothesis for why jawed vertebrates come up that has actually been recently published in some high-level journals like PNAS supposedly shows an association between the rise of these large-bodied active predators and increases in oxygen, which is sort of there in the nectonic revolution theories as well. The problem is that it's not clear there should be any association between the diversification of fishes and rise in oxygen levels, because the limiting factor is not oxygen, it's how much oxygen the animal can actually take in. And so it's gill size, it's activity level, it's gulping. A lot of the things early on have lungs. So it's not clear that there should be an association. Plus, in the later Devonian, oxygen levels actually drop, and yet the same groups just keep going. So as a hypothesis, that needs a lot more testing.
So you said they had lungs.
Yes, so ancestrally all bony fishes have lungs. So even the earliest rayfin fishes, which are the relatives of salmon and tuna, actually have lungs, which become swim bladders in a lot of other living fishes.
Okay. Because I always thought that they would have had gills, and then lungs was a terrestrial development if, like, the gill slits closed over. But I'm not a vertebrate worker, so I don't know much about that.
We have lung fishes today. And also, coelacanths once had lungs, but they filled it up with fat as they become deep sea animals.
Oh, wow.
So they don't have lungs anymore. Things that don't have lungs, sharks and placoderms probably did not. But most of the bony fishes do, ancestrally.
Could you tell us what happened to the vertebrate diversity at the end of the Devonian period?
Well, at the end of the Devonian period, everything suddenly collapsed. So you have this mass extinction event called the Hagenberg event, which happens right at the very boundary of the Devonian and the Carboniferous. So for a long time, it wasn't known exactly what happened to the vertebrates at that point in time or at an earlier mass extinction, which is known as the Kelvasser event, some 12, 15 million years earlier. And that was kind of a strange oversight because it had been known forever that various invertebrate groups actually went extinct at those time periods. So, for example, the reefs die at the Kelvasser event, and then later on, other pelagic forms like Eurypterids, trilobites, ammonites actually die at the end of Devonian. And vertebrates, being also pelagic animals, die there too, as it turns out. So placoderms had been going strong. They had dominated all the ecosystems, both freshwater and saltwater, and the same thing with lobe-finned fishes. And then suddenly most of the groups of those animals disappear. And what you're left with are just a handful of survivors from these major groups. They keep going for a while in this phenomenon called dead clade walking and then eventually die out. And certain members of those groups, such as lungfish and coelacanths, have basically been in that state since then. Coelacanths look like coelacanths the whole time through. Lungfish has become freshwater and look pretty much like the Australian lungfish that's alive today. And they really just never do anything interesting again. And meanwhile, other groups that had been really rare before the mass extinction, like tetrapods, sharks, rayfin fishes, suddenly radiate and then take over the ecosystems in both the freshwater and the saltwater after the Hagenberg event. So the entire vertebrate diversity, as it had been known in the Devonian, is eliminated and replaced with this new vertebrate diversity, this new fauna that looks more like what we have today.
So do we know why both of these extinction events happened?
So for the Kelvasser event, it's actually becoming less of an extinction event as time goes on. So it used to be thought it was a big five mass extinction event, kind of like the end Cretaceous kills everything. Now, except for the reefs, it looks like everything else dies rather slowly over this 25 million year biotic crisis. And maybe because of the same faunal interchange that I spoke about before, where you have things from one continent moving to another, you have invasions by foreign species, sort of like when you have species invasions today from introduced things like pythons or house sparrows. And so you get really not so much an extinction, but a lack of production of new forms because you end up with the same species everywhere. For the end Devonian event, it's not really clear either what happened. It seems to be a double pulsed event. So there's this first pulse where you have deposition of black shale, which usually marks mass extinction events, and that's been associated with volcanism and also sulfur in the water column. And that's really when all the marine things die. So you have sites where you have a lot of marine things, especially vertebrates, like the Cleveland Shale, which is the famous site for Dunkleosteus, the big armor-plated placoderm. And then above that, you have a layer with no fossils in it. That's this black shale. And afterwards, you have none of those things persisting. The second pulse is associated with a sandstone deposition, where you actually have glaciers in the tropics at sea level and on the pole. For the first time in tens of millions of years, you have glaciers anywhere. And so what happens is sea level falls, and you have the deposition of terrestrial river valley sediments over what had been open ocean. So it's almost like this scrubbing action where you have sea level rise, anoxia, death of the marine, and then sea level falls and that kills all the freshwater animals. And so the result is complete devastation of vertebrate ecosystems.
With the what was it, Kielbasa?
Yeah.
Kielbasa?
Kielbasa.
With the Kielbasa event just 12 or 15 million years before, is it possible that it could be a triple pulse extinction event? Or how do you separate the two, the Kielbasa and the Hangenberg events?
Well, it's separated because there's some recovery of the invertebrate faunas going into the Hangenberg event. So they do seem to have different triggers. As far as the biotic crisis goes, if it's not so much an extinction event and more this destabilization of invertebrate faunas because of other forces, it may be that that sort of pulled the rug out from under the vertebrates, that you have their food being decimated one by one or no production of new species of prey items. And so then when something really bad, really from an external environmental trigger comes and hits, then all the vertebrates are wiped out. So it's sort of like a house of cards that you have this long-term removal of the base, and so the top just goes as soon as it's hit. But that needs further study as well.
Did the extinctions all happen at the same time in the same place, or was it a gradual thing from region to region? Are you able to correlate the last appearances of the fossil vertebrates in each locality to about the same age, or?
Yes. So the Hangenberg event is nice because, like most bio events, it has a black shale that marks exactly when it is. And being near the Devonian Carboniferous boundary, you can also use index fossils to determine when it happens as well. And so we have localities from Australia, from South Africa, from China, from North America, from Europe that all show that you have these classic Devonian vertebrates around right up to the end of the period. And in the Carboniferous, you have nothing like that. So in China, they don't really have that many Carboniferous vertebrates at all. And it's the same thing in North America as well. You get shark teeth, but you get no trace of placoderms, loaf, and fishes afterwards. So this does seem to be a global event happening at the same time. Of course, because the extinction's been recognized so recently, it may be that when we go out and look for new sites, we'll find that it's gotten even wider spread than it's appreciated at the moment. So for a long time, it was thought that the Devonian Carboniferous boundary was just missing. Now it's thought that maybe it was washed away by the sea level rising or lack of deposition when the sea level fell.
The volcanic activity that was going on, did that deposit a large ash cloud across an ash bed across a lot of the world, or is it just localized?
It's not clear at the moment, but what they think it is that the Siberian Traps opened up, which is this huge volcanic field in Siberia that's the end Permian extinction, which is the day that life really died, has already been attributed to this specific opening. So it may be that that happened and there was more volcanism in general across Europe and North America and elsewhere. So it's pretty sure that there must have been a lot of ash at that time. If you have sulfur high in the water column, something is being thrown down.
Was there a similar kind of extinction in terrestrial ecosystems? I mean, it wasn't. When we think about things becoming terrestrial, we think about a fish walking up onto land first. But before then, we had arthropods on land, we had plants on land. Was there something similar with them?
Well, there's some evidence that there was. So Archaeopteryx, which is the earliest tree, actually does go extinct right at the end of the Devonian. And so perhaps that opens up terrestrial ecosystem space for all the later things, like the ferns, for example, that seem to dominate Carboniferous ecosystems. And there's some evidence that there might be Roemer's Gap in their record as well, although that's being studied at the moment by other people. There was also evidence that was presented by Peter Ward and his colleagues that insects seem to undergo some kind of stasis during that time period. But of course, that assumes that there are insects around in the Devonian, which is not clear past a few fossils. So it may be that if there were insects or there were arthropods on land, if the same pattern is seen there, that they go extinct and then you have this diversification of insects afterwards. But it seems like if you have glaciers at sea level and you have extinctions in the freshwater, then something must be going on terrestrially as well. Because all of the ecosystems at that time are still connected. There's nothing that's really wholly terrestrial that can make do without having access to some kind of lake ecosystem at that time.
Of all the groups affected, the ones that we see that have survived the extinction event, was it just that they took up kind of marginal niches, kind of ecological roles?
So the death seems to be sudden, that you just have these animals and then you don't have them anymore. And they had been incredibly diverse before the extinction. So placoderms filled every single role from top apex predator in the ocean to freshwater benthic feeder, something like catfish today. So it actually is not clear why, if even one lineage made it through, why they couldn't have just rediversified. But we have no evidence of there being placoderms afterwards at all. So there's no lagging effect where they suddenly go extinct. However, for other groups, like the lobe-finned fishes, which are things like lungfish and coelacanths, a lot of their relatives did actually, well, a few of their relatives did actually make it through the extinction event. So one or two lineages of these things called rhizodonts and megalichthids, which looks something like Eustachonopteron, like the fish with legs, sort of relative of tetrapods. So they make it through, but they never diversify into anything again. So despite being from these hugely diverse groups in the Devonian, they get into the Carboniferous. They keep going for a few tens of millions of years, always looking the same, and then they die off. And so it's not clear why they should have been incapable of doing anything. But it might be that they're occupying sort of marginal niches or niches that are hard to get to. So they are apex predators. They are fresh. Some of the other survivors are freshwater filter feeders. And they just persist for a while, never become anything else. Whereas those groups that make it through that do diversify, like the early tetrapods, and the ray fin fishes and the sharks have been sort of more generalist. So they were maybe ram feeders in the ocean, just swimming around with their mouths open, eating whatever comes along. And they hadn't really been specialized or diverse before the extinction. So perhaps there's more potential there. Maybe it's just luck of the draw, roll of the dice, that they happened to get to the new space first after the extinction and the other ones were left behind.
Okay, how long did it take to actually get all the diversity back or the empty niches filled after the extinction?
So it took something between 10 and 20 million years, which sounds like a hugely long time because evolution is supposed to be instantaneous. But this is actually pretty common after mass extinction events. So after the Ordovician extinction, it took around that long, where you have whole areas around the equator, as recently came out, that don't even have fossils for 5 million years after the mass extinction. And it's the same thing with after the end Cretaceous, where the first stage of the Paleocene is pretty depauperate. So you have a few mammals, but nothing like what you see later when you get whales and elephants and everything else. So for the first part after the end Devonian extinction, it's actually been known for a long time that there wasn't much around. So this was called Roemer's Gap, that there's a hiatus in the tetrapod record that lasts about that 10 to 20 million years, where you just find not very many tetrapods at all. But afterwards, you find the earliest amphibians and the earliest amniotes, the egg-laying land dwellers, and this whole diversity of tetrapods. And then you see the same pattern in the ray fin fishes and the sharks as well, where they reach peak diversity about 20 million years after. But they do have a fossil record that extends all the way back to the beginning. So it doesn't appear to be sampling, because rock volumes show that there's an equal amount of fossil-bearing rock, both in the late Devonian and the early Carboniferous. The other thing is that it isn't as if there are no vertebrates during the early Carboniferous. You can buy, say, an early Tordesian, which is the first stage after the Devonian, ray fin fish for just a few dozen dollars on eBay, for example. And these come from Russia, these come from Scotland, these come from New Brunswick, and they're found in huge abundance, where you have these death assemblages of just multiple members of each species on the same slab. And the thing is that sometimes you do find tetrapod bits in those same localities, but it's just one part of a humerus, maybe one or two specimens. So compared to thousands of specimens, that shows that the tetrapods really are not diverse at that point in time. And plus, they're not terrestrial, so they really have nowhere else to go. They have to be aquatic. They're preserved the same way. So not finding them suggests that something real is going on in association with knowing about the extinction event.
And so when it did get going in the Carboniferous, how did it really differ in diversity and ecology from the late Devonian?
So the survivors seem to have gone for different roles. So in the Devonian, most things are relatively large, over a meter long. They tend to be fish-shaped, so things like the lobe-finned fishes and the placoderms. You tend to have strange things like Bothriolepis, which is a bottom dweller that has claws for fins. In the aftermath, everything seems to be somewhat smaller. So you have really small tetrapods. Most of the fishes are only 10 centimeters. An apex predator is a meter long. And you have the first appearance of things like deep-bodied angelfishes or eels. And in sharks, you have this huge abundance of shell-crushing fishes show up. So it's a really different ecosystem and how it functions than what had been around before, where most things were predators of, or meat eaters or piscivores, rather, of certain sizes and lengths. Now it's much more focused on interaction with the invertebrate realm, life in reefs, life near shore, life terrestrially. It's just different.
Did any other fauna have any similar changes, kind of a decrease in size?
So that remains to be tested. There just hasn't been that much work. So it's known, for example, that the ammonoids lost some of their morph space in the immediate aftermath. So they had lost some of their niche space, perhaps to some of the new fishes. It's known that Eurypterids, for example, become completely freshwater in the Carboniferous, which is what happens to some of the fishes as well, like the lungfishes become completely freshwater afterwards, and there's some other habitat shifts among the survivors. But this really is going to require a lot more data. So even for the Lilliput effect in the vertebrates, that hasn't been tested quantitatively yet. It seems to be there. It seems like an important thing to know about for discussing why it took so long for things to recover and start to get large again, which really doesn't happen till the Mesozoic. But the data just hasn't been there. And part of the problem is that most databases that are used for this kind of research involve marine invertebrates, which don't show the same pattern at the Antimonian. The benthic marine invertebrates seem to get through without many effects at all. So brachiopods and crinoids just keep going. And they diversify like crazy during this period when the vertebrates are laid low during Roemer's Gap. And so if you were testing them for extinction signal, which is what's been used in the past, you wouldn't see anything at all. So now that we know that there is this mass extinction event of vertebrates, of Eurypterids, of ammonoids, of trilobites, now we need to focus in and see what exactly happened afterwards.
Could you explain what this Lilliput effect is?
So the Lilliput effect is that there's a reduction in size in lineages that make it through a mass extinction event. It was first noted in invertebrates, and it's been said to happen in sharks after the end Permian, although it's not clear that it happens there. It's supposed to be that there's less productivity in sort of this destroyed ecosystem, and so the body sizes at the same trophic levels in the same niches tend to be smaller than they were before the mass extinction, and that taxa tend to be smaller than their ancestors. But it's sort of a controversial concept because it's really hard to prove.
Yeah, I can imagine, because you'd think that possibly being a bigger, for example, predator, you might be able to catch more food, and so being bigger would be more of an advantage.
Yeah. It also might be that if you're smaller, you have shorter generation times. So if there's not that much food to go around, it might be better just to grow as quickly as possible to adult size, reproduce, get it over with, and let the next generation handle it.
Oh, we'll be getting into heterochrony and all that, which I think is a bit beyond this one.
Yeah.
So, how significant were the Andevonian extinctions in shaping modern vertebrate evolution?
So that's really what sets the stage for what we have now. So the whole lobe-finned fish, placoderm-dominated fauna that was around in the Devonian was stable. There's no reason that we can't have placoderms and lobe-finned fishes dominating now. But the Devonian extinction seems to have been sort of more severe on the aquatic vertebrates than maybe any other extinction event as far as we know, although that remains to be tested as well because there just hasn't been that much attention on fishes at these other mass extinction events. So it may be that it reset things completely, that it leveled the playing field, made it possible for any group coming through to dominate. And so whereas ray-finned fishes have been really sort of marginal, undiverse, not that many species of them, there's only a dozen known from the Devonian versus 30,000 that are alive today. In the immediate aftermath of the extinction, they're able to diversify to start to dominate faunas, much like they do now. So you probably have about the same proportions abundance-wise and diversity-wise in the aftermath of the Devonian extinction event as you have now, where you have ray-finned fishes dominate, then you have sharks to a lesser extent, and then a few aquatic tetrapods that are then becoming terrestrial. And tetrapods before the Devonian extinction had been relatively minor as well. They were living aquatic lifestyles, much like the lobe-finned fishes, filling the same niches. They weren't on land yet. They were found in a few places around Europe and North America, and that was it. So it wasn't clear that they would have taken the direction that they have in the aftermath, where they've become terrestrial primarily, where they've taken on other roles. Perhaps it would have happened eventually, but probably, I don't know what happens when you rewind the evolutionary tape. It probably doesn't play back exactly the same way. And so perhaps other groups would have filled those roles instead.
I've really enjoyed this episode, especially as it's, my area of interest.
Well, I am actually really impressed at the kind of things that we did here because I had absolutely no idea about the origin of the skeleton. I just assumed that seeing as we had chordates, which had the notochord in there, I just assumed that that would eventually have mineralized, become the backbone, and then all the other bones somehow would have grown around it. I don't know, I didn't really think about it. But showing this really shows how much there is to learn.
And the skeleton itself is, you might think of it as like one consistent system, but single unit, but it's actually a phylogenetic, or well, is it an evolutionary and developmental composite of like at least four or five different systems. So you've got like the two systems that make up the skull, which is the neurocranium, which first appear unmineralized in like hagfish and lampreys, and then you've got the visocranium, which is the face effectively and jaws, which is in hagfish and lampreys but isn't really manifest or mineralized until like placoderms and jawed vertebrates. And then you've got the axial skeleton, so the vertebral column, and the appendicular skeleton, the arms and legs, and the dermal skeleton, so like scales and teeth and things like that.
As always, if you have any questions or comments about this episode, please feel free to post them on the bottom of the webpage or on our forum, and Joe will do his best to answer them.
Yeah, I'll try. Well, Dave, I'll see you next time. It's been a pleasure, as always.
I'll see you then, Joe.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Shall we mention Archaeogonaspis ludensis?
Yeah, give it to me. So, yes, Dave a while back found Archaeogonaspis, a heterostracon, the oldest heterostracon type of jawless fish in the British Isles. And he won't give it to me because I want to chop it in half.
I think that's a pretty reasonable reason for not giving you a fossil.
I want to chop
the
it in
oldest.
half.
The oldest heterostracon in the UK because you want to chop it in half.
I had a look at the Natural History Museum specimens of Archaeogonaspis and they're rubbish compared to your one. Let me chop it in half for science.
For science. Yeah, we'll see. Everyone knows about it now. I showed it Lauren.
Did he? Oh,
Yeah.
no. What did she say?
I was like, Lauren, you can have this if you want. You can cut it in half.
Ah!